Heavenly Father, we are so glad that you are in our lives. We are so glad you came to save us. And we do pray that through the wisdom of your word, we'd get a more fully orbed view of what that looks like, the sort of people you have saved, what it means to actually live in this world, what the world is like. We do pray that you would help us to have a really biblical view of ourselves and of our need for you. Lord, for any here who are struggling with despair because of unfulfilled expectations, Lord, do particularly minister to them this morning as we see the struggles of a godly man. So speak to us through your word, we pray, for Jesus' sake. Amen. Okay, on the screen, we're going to read that. It's Ecclesiastes chapter 3, the poem on time. There is a time for everything and a season for every activity under the heavens. A time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to uproot. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to tear down and a time to build. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to scatter stones and a time to gather them. A time to embrace, and a time to refrain from embracing. A time to search, and a time to give up. A time to keep, and a time to throw away. A time to tear, and a time to mend. A time to be silent, and a time to speak. A time to love, and a time to hate. A time for war, and a time for peace. What do workers gain from their toil? I have seen the burden God has laid on the human race. He has made everything beautiful in its time. He has also set eternity in the human heart. Yet no one can fathom what God has done from beginning to end. We know that frustration of time, don't we? Time, time, time. There is a right time to set up a business, a right time to collapse it. There's a right time to keep and a right time to throw away. And no doubt that's a dispute amongst many married couples here. There's a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. It's always very awkward, isn't it, when you meet people you haven't seen for a few years in the jacuzzi or in the swimming pool. Well, that's a time to refrain from embracing. And you know, it really is the holy grail of wisdom literature to know the right time for every single action, decision, and attitude we should have. I don't know whether you've heard the story about the shepherd who's tending his flock, and suddenly there's a dust cloud in the distance, out of which appears a high-speed silver BMW car. And a young driver in an Armani suit gets out of the car and says to the shepherd, "Hey," and he's just driven the car right to the middle of this flock of sheep, "Hey, if I can tell you how many sheep you've got, will you give me one of them?" Anyway, the shepherd looked at the man and then at his peacefully grazing flock and said, "Sure." Anyway, the driver got into his car again and plugged in his satellite navigation system, which had some special device that had a heat sensor high up in space. And he programmed out an answer. And he said to the shepherd, "You have exactly 1,586 sheep." "Impressive," said the shepherd. "One of my sheep is yours." So he watched this young man select an animal and bundle it into his car. Then the shepherd said, "Hey, look, if I can tell you what your job is, will you give me my sheep back?" And after a nod of acceptance, the young man said, "Yeah, if you can." Without any hesitation, the shepherd said, "You're a management consultant, aren't you?" And the man said, "Yeah, absolutely. How did you know? How did you manage to guess?" He said, "Oh, it was no guess. First of all, you drove into my field uninvited. Second, you asked me to pay for information I already had. You offered to answer questions I wasn't asking, and you know nothing about my business. So give me my dog back. So might as well smile before we really get into the bleakness of Ecclesiastes. But there's a true story of, and this isn't a funny story, it's a time management consultant who's telling all these busy people how to use time well. And he put this big glass tank on the table in front of everyone, and he had some rocks. And he put the rocks into the glass tank and until the rocks were right at the top, and said to all the consultants, all the people he was speaking to, is it full? They said, yeah, it's full. He said, do you think so? He then got some pebbles, some smaller pebbles, and put them into the tank. And sure enough, they filled the slightly bigger, the slightly smaller spaces. And then he said, is the tank filled? And they all said, probably not. You're learning. Well done, you're learning. So he then got some gravel, and he poured that in. Is it filled now? Probably not. So he got the sand, and then finally he got water, and he filled in every single space until it just got to the top. And then he said, what's the lesson in all this? And somebody on the front row said, no matter whatever you've done, there's always more to do. No. Somebody else said, well, no matter how much you're filling your life with, you can always fill it with more. No, that's not the lesson. He said, unless you put the big rocks in first, you'll never get them in at all. If you start putting the smaller stuff in first, you'll never get the big stuff in afterwards. And in terms of, in our notes, in terms of looking at lordship and priority in life, the lordship of Christ, and yet priorities under that lordship, I think what's most right about evangelicalism is that we are good at getting the big stones in first. You know, redemption, judgment, heaven, hell, a central focus on evangelism and Bible teaching. We are good about those big stone priorities. And that's why we should remain evangelical. Because the trouble is, other traditions, liberals, talk about lots of really good stuff to do with restructuring the world and injustice, everything else, all really good stuff. But often they find that once they put those smaller things in, there's no room for the big stuff. But the Lord is also interested in the smaller stones because they are throughout the scriptures, especially in the wisdom literature. Work, friendship, culture, arts, politics, being human. The Lord wants us to get to heaven, but he's also interested in the sort of people who get there. He wants us to be good company. He doesn't want to be surrounded by people who are only interested in church activities. He's going to spend eternity with us. He's interested in how we interact with each other and how we treat his world. Because there's a continuity between this life and the life of the world to come. But as Ecclesiastes keeps telling us, there's a continuity between Eden and life east of Eden. And now he's giving us responsibilities under the sun that prepare us for the life of the world to come. And to suggest that we're not interested in those areas of life because they're not as important as evangelism or Bible study is to dehumanize ourselves, to cause us to become narrow and diminished. So creation is not a nothing. But on the other hand, if we make it too much in the sense that we try the acquisitive approach of achieving a net gain, of holding on to stuff, if we try and locate our significance in what we've achieved under the sun in this world, what we've managed to store away for ourselves, it will end up like a big bubble that bursts. A nothingness. Chapter 1:14, a chasing of the wind. Now the teacher is still asking us to hold this tension between life being fallen and feeling futile and painful, but at the same time he wants us to be alive to God and all the things he's provided for us in his world. And if you look again at some point through the reader that talks about enjoying a good life, I think it's the one called Enjoy Life While You Can. We see that there's a wonderful celebration of life. But we can't get away from the fact that life, this side of Eden, is painful. Look in your notes under B, the frustration of fallenness and the joy of living as dependent creatures. I'm afraid these numbers have got a bit mixed up, so we're sort of doing one big block, so don't worry too much about the exact headings. I think a C should have been a 2 or something like that, but I can't see what you've got, but it's got a bit mixed up. But let me read from chapter 2 in your notes. He says, I hated life because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me, all of it meaningless, a chasing after the wind. I hated all the things I toiled for under the sun because I must leave them to the one who comes after me. And who knows whether that person will be wise or foolish, yet they will have control over all the fruit of my toil into which I've poured my effort and skill under the sun. This too is meaningless. So my heart began to despair over all my toilsome labor under the sun. For a person may labor with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, and then they must leave all they own to another who has not toiled for it. This too is meaningless and a great misfortune. What do people get for all the toil and anxious striving with which they labor under the sun? All their days their work is grief and pain. Even at night their minds do not rest. This too is meaningless. A person can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in their own toil. This too, I see, is from the hand of God. For without him, who can eat or find enjoyment? Now, the next heading says that in a pre-fallen and a fallen world and in the life of the world to come, it's in God's service that perfect freedom lies. It's so easy, isn't it, to get it wrong about work. Either to see it as a necessary evil, we work to feed our face merely, or to idolize it. In the Greek world, work was considered a curse, and it possibly is in student culture as well, I don't know. But Aristotle said this, that to be unemployed was good fortune because one could then participate in political life and contemplation. And then the medieval church baptized this Greek view of work so that the monastic vocation was considered far superior to rolling up your sleeves and digging the garden or doing some other form of work. But later, in the Reformation, the church rediscovered the cultural mandate. Magisterial reformers like Luther realized that everything we do must be a calling from God, including our work. And it was such an important emphasis. But even with that legacy, the preacher wants to goad us. He wants to pull us away from perhaps an unquestioned Protestant work ethic that tells us to glorify God by working hard and doing well in the world. And that's the code certainly many Christians in the West work to. Be godly and wise, use your money well, give your kids a good education, and then you'll prosper and you'll be a significant witness in the community. And for some Christians, that seems to have delivered. They have worked hard. The Lord has blessed them materially. And they have possessions and reputations and perhaps a voice in the academy or in the workplace somewhere else. But then, of course, we have to remember that a huge proportion of Christians in the world today don't have enough work to even feed, clothe, or send their kids to school. So we need to hear the teacher's wisdom. And he tells us that there's a built-in frustration to work and life in a fallen world. And the frustrations are essentially threefold. I'm going to add a fourth. But they're toil, death, and evil. So let's look at this first one, toil. That's the word used to describe work throughout Ecclesiastes 1, chapter 3. What do people gain from all their labors at which they toil under the sun? Chapter 3, verse 9. What do workers gain from their toil? Why does he keep using that word? Well, because that's the difference this side of Eden. In Eden, we do see Adam and Eve working hard, tilling the garden, naming the animals, relating to each other. Adam even has time to write a poem to his wife, "Bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh." But it's all total worship to God. It wasn't that they had hymn books or Bibles or church buildings to go to. Everything they did was worship of their Creator. But look at what happens after the fall on the PowerPoint. Genesis 3, 17 to 19. Notice how Ecclesiastes it is, or rather the other way around. "Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil you will eat food from it all the days of your life. The earth will produce thorns and thistles for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your brow you will eat your food, until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you will return." So the mandate's still there, it's intact. They need to till the earth, they need to eat, they need to raise children. And the preacher deliberately keeps returning to Genesis, toil, returning to dust. In fact, there's a strong case for seeing the first 11 chapters of Genesis as a framework for the book of Ecclesiastes. Let me try this one on you. So Genesis starts with a paradise of Eden, in which work is without toil, it is a delight. But then it takes us out of Eden, through the fall, and into a world where work is toil, there's death and evil. And then we go right through to the flood of Noah and the opportunity to start again. But even with a fresh canvas to paint on, work is toil, death obtains, and evil destroys lives. So then we have the Tower of Babel and pride and technique and the desire for a gain. They wanted a name. This was the great wisdom project of Babel. We don't need God. We'll build a tower to God with our technology, with our technique. And that's always the temptation, isn't it? It's always the temptation to become independent of God and to focus on what we can achieve. I think we leaders only need 5 minutes taste of success, and we've got grandiose Babel-like plans of a ministry that's going to reach up to heaven. But God is constantly committed to frustrating the labors of humans if they ever get such notions. And he introduces incoherence, meaninglessness, frustration of their language. And do you see the similarities? And in the light of all this, the Hebrew word hevel, translated emptiness, meaningless, becomes the word to describe life and work in a fallen world. And surely it can't be a coincidence that this word hevel is given to the tragic figure of Genesis 4, whom we know as Abel. It's exactly the same word. So Abel worked hard under the sun, serves the Lord faithfully, but ends up being murdered by his own brother. What did he gain for being a righteous man, being a man of faith whose sacrifice was acceptable? Well, he ended up getting the envy of his brother and was murdered so brutally and needlessly. Meaningless, meaningless. Empty, empty. So this word, hevel, Abel, contains something of life's transience, its tragedy, its sorrow, and its irony. And also our inability to hold on to life, our inability to find permanent satisfaction in any of life's aspects. And it also voices our inability to make sense of some of the twisted and difficult happenings in our lives. And it reminds us that all we do is characterized by toil. Now, that's our experience, isn't it? Just to keep order, just to keep the emails in some semblance of order. My chairman of the board, John Lenton, who's here, advised me a couple of years ago to have an email amnesty, just to delete all my emails and see what happens. It's brilliant advice, but I'm too scared to do it. And we're all the same. The emails flood in. The emails flood in. Well, I was going to say, and the sea is never full. The sea is always full, I suppose, when it comes to emails. But just to give a family a happy background, we need to toil, don't we? to cook, tidy, wash clothes, bathe, put to bed. Don't you, with young families, those of you ever despair at the endless toil of that? And what's the legacy? What, you know, what do you have to gain from all that? Just a mess. And you start again the next day. And it's true in all areas of life. And what's most frightening is that whilst it takes all that energy to bring up a family or build a business or do a ministry, it just takes one tiny bit of folly to pull it all down again. Ever ruin the family outing with a crossword? Sarcastic comment? I do it all the time. We invest all that money in a holiday, and then everyone's frumping around in a bad mood because I've been an idiot. We're running to stand still. We feel like we're chasing the wind. It's a wonderful expression if you've ever seen a dog chasing a car. It's a stupid thing to do, to chase the wind. It's going to end in your exhaustion and your eventual collapse with nothing to show for it. Whether we're in the office, the study, or the classroom, wherever we do our work, there's an endless repetitive toil. There's a futility and a frustration. And that's why we're desperate to acquire labour-saving devices. I don't think there's a single business or ministry that doesn't, where the employees don't want a PA. And that includes the PA. Everyone wants a PA. The PA wants a PA. Because work is just so hard. It's no surprise, is it, that Dyson, James Dyson, who makes the vacuum cleaners, he's a multimillionaire. And Bamford, who makes the big JCB diggers, he's a billionaire. Because we want somebody to do the cleaning and the digging for us. But we clean, we dig, and the work is never done. As it says in your notes, life is one long process of getting tired. I'm probably making you tired just reflecting on it. I love the lyrics in Cat Stevens' song, Matthew and Son. That's up on the screen. Up at 8, you can't be late for Matthew and Son. He won't wait. Watch them run down to platform 1 and the 8:30 train to Matthew and Son. And this is the refrain here. Matthew and Son, the work's never done. There's always something new. The files in your head, you take them to bed. You're never, ever through. And they've been working all day, all day, all day, all day, all day, all day. I think it's absolutely wonderful that the Bible is realistic about our work. It sees it as created, and we have a mandate to do it, but also it's cursed. By contrast, I think society in the late 19th and 20th century, we began to baptize work, as you'll see on the screen. The man who builds a factory builds a temple. The man who works there worships there. Well, as Henry Ford said, work is the salvation of the human race, morally, physically, socially. Yabu sucks, says the preacher. It's a myth. Well, quickly, the second frustration is death. This came at the fall as well. By the sweat of your brow, you will eat your food until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken. Sorry, for from it you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you will return. And if at some point you look at your sheet, the frustration of the dead end. There's constant illusion that there's a time. There's a time for everything, but ultimately, there's a time to die. Those who've reached midlife, when you realize you're actually nearer death than you are to your youth, and, wow, I haven't really achieved what I thought to. That becomes very, very focused, doesn't it? In your notes, we see Tina Gordoin writes in the London Times, your 30s are about how great life can really be. Before you hit 40 and realize your job sucks, your marriage is a nightmare, your kids are dysfunctional, and you're going to die. A few years ago, it occurred to me, and it was a real shock. I was not particularly thinking about anything profound, but it suddenly dawned on me. I'm working with students all the time. I thought, hang on, I am nearer to retirement age in the future than I am to my days as a student. And I suddenly became very melancholy and sad at how little I had done in my life. I love the film clip on the first night from Ants. The breakthrough for Woody Allen's character. Yes, he discovered he was insignificant. Well, Woody Allen also said this, and it's on the PowerPoint. I don't want to achieve immortality through my work. I want to achieve it through not dying. He's so good, isn't he? And that's built into all of us, and it's a constant frustration. Well, so much for toil and death. What about evil and injustice? Chapter 3, 16 says this, I saw something else under the sun. In the place of judgment, wickedness was there. In the place of justice, wickedness was there. That's a hard one. It always has been a hard one for God's people. One of the main reasons for Paul writing the epistle to the Romans was because they were struggling with two big discouragements, and they were sin and death. Why is it that post-resurrection, Christians, just like the pagans around them, grow old and get sick and die, and are still sinful, and their marriages fall apart, and they do bad things? Why is there death? Why is there sin within the Christians? Because surely we've been raised to life. We're going to come back to that right at the end. It was a great pleasure for me a few weeks ago to get to know Archbishop Ben Kwoshi from Nigeria. And we had an evening with him where he shared about his life and his ministry and some of the things he has to face. Now, like all of us, he has the toil of working hard with his own mortality. He's not as young as he used to be. But also, he lives in the shadow of the wickedness of Islamic extremists. And over the years, they've repeatedly attacked him and his family. They've killed his staff. They've attacked his church members. They raped and beat his wife until she was blind and broken. They burnt his house, his church, and all his possessions. I mean, isn't life hard enough just to build something up? Because it is a toil, and we aren't getting any younger. And then add on top of that evil and injustice. What we struggle to build, what we find the most precious, is suddenly destroyed or at best harmed. That is very, very hard. Do you remember my comments yesterday about being wary of neat wisdom formulas? You know, just follow these approaches in life and you will lead the good life under the Lord. You'll be in the center of his will. Everything will be okay if you're there. You see, if we don't heed the warnings of the preacher, if we don't question those kind of wisdom traditions, then we're going to be vulnerable to a far more reaching and negative cynicism. And I think the failure of some evangelical formulas has caused many people to give up the faith. I was praying with a brother earlier today, and he comes from a Central European country where in his denomination, out of 20 pastors in the denomination, in the past year, all but three have had to retire due to broken marriage and despair and disillusionment with the ministry. It's so shocking. Well, so much for toil, death, and wickedness. There is a fourth factor here, which was a discovery for me, and for some reason doesn't seem to be much on the radar of the commentators. So treat it warily. But it's something that both adds to the frustration and yet draws out the deepest feelings of what it means to be human. Verse 11. He's made everything beautiful in its time. He has also set eternity in the human heart. Yet no one can fathom what God has done from beginning to end. You see, even in this fallen world that we've just had described for us, where there's a time for birth, a time for death, a time for planting, a time for uprooting, it does make you tired, doesn't it? You hear the refrain, time, time, time. Even within that, God has made this world breathtakingly beautiful. And he's set eternity in our hearts. So we love to know the time for everything. We look out at this wonderful city and we think, oh, I would love to explore this. I'd love to climb those mountains over there. I'd love to go to the sauna. I'd love to do this. Everything is beautiful in its time. And we want to explore it. We want to achieve. We want to do stuff. And that's really wonderful. But of course, having put eternity in our hearts, he's also put 70 years in our bodies. And there's a mismatch, isn't there?
And so we long to leave our mark. We don't want to be like the beasts who just live for a few years and die. How can we be different to them? Maybe by accumulating, maybe by having elaborate projects, maybe by having a ministry that will last forever after us. But it's all doomed to frustration. Do you remember that wonderful scene in Ridley Scott's film Blade Runner? I should just give you a bit of background. Do you know Blade Runner, Director's Cut? Yeah, good, you're familiar with it. It's a really old film now. But it's a dystopic film. It's an end-of-world thing where technology has kind of ruined the Earth and there's nothing really much that's natural that's left. And there's a new breed of humans or humanoid creatures who are made. They're manufactured, replicants. And they're made in their maker's image. They're given implanted memories. But they also have enhanced strength and capacity. Now, they behave really well and do lots of good jobs for everyone until they realize they're programmed to die very young. And then they become unstable. And Harrison Ford, he's the guy who's employed to go and round up these remaining replicants and kill them, shoot them. It's not easy to do because they have this superhuman strength. Anyway, Roy, the leader of the replicants, has this titanic fight with Harrison Ford. But then Roy realizes that the decay process has started and he's going to die within a few minutes. And he begins to quote this poem from Ecclesiastes 3 about time. And then he describes all the beauty he's seen in his short life. The stunning things, the beauty in his life. And then he says this on the PowerPoint, time. All those moments will be lost in time, like tears in rain, a time to die. It is just a really moving moment in the film because he's a replicant, and yet he is the most human character in the entire film because he recognizes that it's not right. There's something bigger within. I mean, it obviously raises questions on what is a human. But what about for us, those beautiful moments in life when you first fell in love? For those of you with children, when your children were born, when they took their first steps, said daddy, mummy, for the first time. Time is going to take them away. They're just under the sun. They're just going to be like tears in the rain. We're going to die. Now, one of the reasons why we should read this book and talk about this book with non-Christians is because it really, really resonates with all humans living under the sun. You see, the preacher is no hard-headed cynic. So what are we to do? We are going to die. Life, work is a toil. But we're designed to be curious about God's world, to explore it, to enjoy it, to order it. To avoid that is to languish and to become less than human. But to fulfill the mandate is frustrating. It's hindered by tiredness through toil, lack of time through death, and sadly, wickedness that ruins much of what we do. Toil and time, toil and time. Well, the road to wisdom and fearing God and deeply depending on Him is a road that takes us through our humanness and our mortality. And unless we take this route, we will not learn wisdom, according to the preacher. We will not fear God. We will not live lives dependent upon Him, but we will try and locate our significance in what we know, the books we write, the ministries, the work we build up, the businesses that we establish. No, no, no. We need to recognize our humanness, the tiredness of toil, the worry of death, the fear of wickedness. There's a wonderful short story by Leo Tolstoy. I don't know whether you know it. It's called How Much Land Does a Man Need? And there's this master of a house, Pahom, and he hears two sisters talking, and they say, oh, we'll never be rich, but we never really lack for anything. And it gets his mind thinking about what it's most important to have in life. And he says this, it's perfectly true, he thought, busy as we are from childhood, tilling Mother Earth, we peasants have no time to let any nonsense settle in our heads. Our only trouble is that we haven't land. We haven't land enough. If I had plenty of land, I shouldn't fear the devil himself. And you can probably guess, even if you haven't read the story, it's a very short story, you can read it in about 15, 20 minutes, that he does accumulate land, but it's not enough. And then he hears about the Bashkirs. And there are people who he thinks are so simple, they're as simple as sheep, and they'll give land for almost nothing. So he says to the Bashkirs, "How much can I have your land for?" And they say, "Oh, the price is always the same, 1,000 rubles a day." He says, "What? 1,000 rubles a day? What kind of price is that?" He said, "Well, the amount of land you can stake out in 24 hours, from sunrise to sunset, it's yours." And he cannot believe this. But they said, there's one condition. The chief of the Bashkirs said, one condition. The place you start out from, you must return to before the sun sets, or you lose your money and the land. So he said, no problem. So he takes his shovel. As soon as the sun rises, off he goes at a brisk trot. And he makes his first mark. He digs a hole and piles up the turfs and said, right, that's nice. The land 2 miles ahead, that's better. So he goes a bit further. And then he thinks, I'm not liking the shape of my land. I'll keep going to the left a little bit. And you can imagine what's happening. The day is getting longer, and he's getting hungry and thirsty. And then he suddenly realizes, this is getting a bit close. Am I going to get back? And so he runs all the way back, and he gets to the foot of this hillock where he started. They're high up on this hill, the people who are selling him the land. And he sees the sun set behind them, and he collapses, thinking, I failed. I've lost everything. And he sees that they're jeering him. And he's in despair. But then he realizes that actually the sun hasn't set. The sun is behind the people on the hill. He can see the reflection of it. And they're not jeering him, they're encouraging him. So with one last effort, he runs up the hill and plants his spade down. But in the process, has a massive heart attack and drops down dead. And Tolstoy says this: his servant picked up the spade and dug a grave long enough for Pahom to lie in and buried him in it. How much land does a man need? 6 feet from his head to his heels. That's all he needed. And Jesus says something very similar in the Gospel age. He says, what should it profit you if you gain the whole world and lose your life? What does it profit you? You cannot hold on to it. There are no pockets in a grave shroud. The frustration is true for all people of all times. The residue, the profit, is nothing. And the final point I want us to make before we finish this morning is that we need to continue holding the tensions. We're only going to do the first one today. We're going to look at understanding the now and the not yet. We're going to look at creation a little bit more tomorrow morning. But let's just look at this. If you could look at that passage in the notes, Romans 8. But just by way of introduction again, just to repeat, that the early church, they were really discouraged by their mortality. Surely since Christ has been raised from the dead, then sin and death are defeated. So why are Christians no different to everybody else? Why do we die? Why are we subject to evil, injustice, and sin in our lives? And at the end of this section on suffering, Paul says this. Verse 18 of chapter 8 of Romans, it's in the notes. I consider that our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in us. For the creation waits in eager expectation for the children of God to be revealed. For the creation was subject to frustration, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it in hope, that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the freedom and glory of the children of God. We know that the whole creation has been groaning, as in the pains of childbirth, right up to the present time. Not only so, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for our adoption to sonship, the redemption of our bodies. So just look at verse 18. Suffering now, glory later. one day all will be well and will be very well. And Archbishop Ben Quashy and all those who suffered so horribly right across the world, they will say, this was the best of all possible worlds, and the life of the world to come makes everything well. Because the present suffering is not to be compared with the future glory. But our reality now, verse 19, is that creation, all of creation is groaning. The world is cursed. And what's it waiting for? It's waiting for the sons and daughters of the living God, the Christians, who are made alive with Christ, who die with him, who are raised with him, to actually retain their position again, post-Eden, to retain their position as stewards of God's creation. And this time, we will do it really well. God has given us new hearts, and we will be fully restored into the image of Christ. And we will rule under Christ, with Christ, the new earth, when Christ comes down and makes his dwelling with us. And the whole of creation is longing for that time. It's frustrated by toil and death and wickedness. And so we must join creation in groaning. You see, the only people not groaning in Romans are the pagans in chapter 1. They just think of themselves as wise. Everything they do, oh, we substitute God for our whatever we make, whatever we accumulate. We'll exchange the self-evident truth of God as creator for the lie of us doing things our own way. They're the only people who don't groan. The wise man or woman groans. The wise Christian groans. Waiting for what? Look at that, at the last verse. Waiting for our adoption to sonship, the redemption of our bodies. Those bodies that are fallen, that are tired, that are decaying, that are dying. One day we will have resurrection bodies like Christ. Robert Browning puts it well, and this is in the notes. Ah, but a man's reach should exceed his grasp. Or what's heaven for? It's right and good that God has put eternity in our hearts, because we've been made for eternity. It's right that we find things beautiful in their time, because death is not a terminus. But we need to be realistic in a groaning world, subject to frustration. We need to hold the tension between the now and the not yet. And the preacher will reveal some very helpful and some very wonderful things to us if we hold on there. He does have a solution. He does have good news for us, but he's going to make us wait. So let's pray. We thank you, Father, so very much for your word. We thank you that you don't patronize us, that you're not a second-hand car salesman who doesn't let us look under the bonnet of what the whole thing looks like. Thank you for giving us a chance to do that. And we do pray that we would be realistic as we look at our lives and our ministries and our families, that we would learn wisdom as we recognize our humanness, our weakness, our great dependence upon you. Lord, I do pray that you would protect the leaders here in their marriages, in their work, in their friendships, in their relationships. You'd protect them from evil people in this world. You'd encourage them in their toil and their labor, in their business and their ministry. And Lord, help us all to have those biblical eyes, those spiritual eyes, as the Holy Spirit gives us that deposit of what's to come. Give us the good sense to groan inwardly, to long for the redemption of our bodies, but not to become disinterested in this world, but to still find it beautiful in its time, to work hard for you, to enjoy this day, the food, the friendship, the sunlight, the beauty of creation, and yet to realize that there is a now and a not yet. We ask this for Jesus' sake. Amen.